Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says Israel is responsible for anything that happens in Gaza while continuing to blockade it and carry out attacks. Hours after losing another election lawsuit, U.S. President Donald Trump attacks Joe Biden for making cabinet choices. South Korea announces fresh coronavirus restrictions amid fears of a new wave of the pandemic in the country. It's good to have you with us. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has slammed the Israeli attacks on the Gaza Strip, saying that the regime is to blame for the new escalation. Hamas spokesman Fawzi Barhoum says that Israel is responsible for everything that happens in Gaza because of the regime's continued blockade and attacks on the coastal enclave. Barhoum stressed that the resistance is only acting in self-defense, in a veiled reference to rocket fires from the Strip. The Israeli military conducted air raids on the cities of Gaza and Khan Yunus overnight. Tanks also hit a Hamas outpost in the town of Rafah. The Tel Aviv regime claimed that they were responding to rocket fire from the Strip, though no Palestinian group claimed responsibility. Israel has been conducting similar strikes on Gaza Strip over the past months. Lebanese President Michel Aoun has criticized normalization of ties between Israel and several Arab states. He says that the move implies a tacit acceptance of losing Jerusalem Al-Quds and the occupied Golan Heights. Aoun was referring to the U.S. broker deals under which the UAE, Bahrain, and Sudan agreed to establish ties with Israel. The deals met fierce condemnation from across the Muslim world. Palestinians have called it a stab in the back. The co-founder of the Free Palestine Movement, Paul Larudi, says that Arab people, unlike the rulers, do not like the idea of normalizing relations with Tel Aviv and support the Palestinian cause.
The Arab world is dividing itself into those who are normalizing, so-called normalizing relationship with Israel, and those who are opposed to it and are in solidarity with Palestinians. The ones who are normalizing their relationship with Israel do not claim to be in solidarity with the Palestinians. In fact, some of them are saying it's time to forget about this. The Palestinians have to make the deal with Israel. I don't think there's a single Arab people anywhere in the Arab world that likes the idea of normalization, or that is not in solidarity with the Palestinians. So the question is whether the leadership is going to go along with the views of and the sympathies of their own people. In the case of Sudan, for example, they really twisted the arms of the leadership there. Threatening, making threats, which the United States often does in these cases, and at the same time offering all sorts of benefits.
Tehran has denounced the U.S. Secretary of State's recent visit to an Israeli settlement in the occupied Palestinian territory. It says that the move was in line with Washington's anti-Palestinian stance.
The trip to the occupied Palestinian territories by the U.S. regime's Secretary of State is a bitter issue. If it weren't for the treason of the rulers of a handful of Arab countries, the U.S. diplomat would not have been emboldened to blatantly travel there and breach U.N. Security Council resolutions, and would not have disobediently approved of Israel's anti-human rights moves.
He said that the treason of certain Arab states and the shamelessness of White House rulers are two sides of the same coin. The spokesman noted those who set the stage for the U.S. to act so blatantly should be held accountable. He also urged the few regional countries that have signed normalization deals with the Tel Aviv regime to return to regional cooperation. The spokesman also called on the Muslim world to remain committed to the cause of the Palestinians. U.S. President Donald Trump has expressed anger at Joe Biden's rush to announce his cabinet lineup. Trump says that his Democratic rival is moving too quickly in forming a cabinet. The Republican president says that his legal team is still fighting to prove voter fraud in the November 3rd presidential election. Biden, who's been projected the winner by the media, is set to unveil his picks this week. Trump has so far refused to concede defeat and continues to file suits in states it believes fraudulent votes have been cast. In the latest blow to his camp, a federal court in Pennsylvania has rejected another case brought in by his lawyers. Also in Wisconsin, staff officials have accused the Trump's observers of obstructing the recount of votes in the state's largest county. The U.S. presidential election has polarized the nation, but a new poll suggests that it's just the latest problem in an already deeply divided society. The poll reveals widespread feelings of disunity, but also little faith that the country will heal anytime soon. Rami Mazahedi reports from Chicago.
The U.S. presidential election remains unresolved, but what seems crystal clear is that the nation is more divided at any time than since the 1960s, or perhaps even the 1860s. A new poll found that nearly 80% of America says they are deeply divided on its most foundational values. Whoever is inaugurated in January will face a deeply mistrustful and disbelieving public, as the poll also finds that just 30% of Americans believe the country will grow more united in 2021. For a nation which is the richest in the world and which faces no serious external threat, such levels of disharmony are shocking even to many Americans themselves.
The far right, now that's really come from almost like Trumpism. If that movement still stays strong, we can see more conflict in the next 4 years. And I think it's really just dependent on how Joe Biden kind of handles the next 4 years, and also what kind of information is really getting flown out of the far right, and whether that gets filtered or not, or whether that gets spread very rapidly.
Distrust is not something which grows overnight. Many attribute the division to the American liberals' obsession with so-called identity politics, which divides and redivides people into smaller and smaller tribes based on gender, race, ethnicity, urban-rural, coastal-inland, and on and on. U.S. conservatives are criticized for having a limited view of unity due to an us-versus-them mentality, which leaves little room for change or modernization.
Right. I think that Republicans and Democrats have become almost like their own tribes where they're not willing to give an inch to the other. I hope that's not going to continue. And I hope that the rhetoric becomes less incendiary as we move forward. But I don't think that Trump is doing anything but fomenting more discontent among groups of people that are already tribalized and having a hard time getting together.
The United States is proving unable to resolve a host of enormous problems. Protecting from the coronavirus pandemic, Great Depression-era levels of unemployment alongside a skyrocketing Wall Street, endemic economic inequality which has exploded in 2020, constant racial discrimination, record disharmony between genders, a Congress which is half as popular as an often deeply unpopular president, and, of course, a disputed election, the third in six tries. The poll makes it clear that belief in the nation's division is not a partisan issue, as Democrats, Republicans, and Independents all agree in similar proportions. Americans can only seem to agree on one thing, that they really, deeply disagree. Rami Mazahari, Chicago.
Now, another news concern is growing over the coronavirus pandemic as the deadly virus keeps taking its toll on countries in East Asia. South Korea reported more than 300 new cases for a fifth straight day on Sunday, bringing the total infections to 30,700. Over 500 people in total have also lost their lives to the virus. The country is planning to tighten social distancing rules for the capital, Seoul, and nearby areas. Japan also saying it may reimpose attendance limits for sports and other large events. as the new infection cases in the country climbed to 2,600. That's a daily record since the disease broke out. The overall infections in Japan passed 130,000 with around 2,000 deaths. The World Health Organization is warning of a third wave of the COVID-19 in Europe early next year if governments there do not address issues needed to prevent the spread of the disease. WHO's special COVID-19 envoy, David Navarro, says that European governments must build the necessary infrastructure to prevent a third wave. Navarro noted that the governments had missed prevention steps during the summer after bringing the first wave under control. He underlined that such a failure caused the ongoing second wave of the disease on the continent. Europe saw a reduced caseload for a brief period, but infections are again wreaking havoc ahead of the winter holiday season. Now let's move on with the rest of this broadcast. Armenians have again taken to the streets of the capital Yerevan, calling for the resignation of Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan. Demonstrators also voiced opposition to a recent deal with Azerbaijan over the disputed Nagorno-Karabakh region. Yerevan has witnessed several such rallies since Pashinyan signed the ceasefire agreement. The accord announced on November 10th secured territorial advances for Azerbaijan into the disputed region. Pashinyan called the deal a disaster, but he said that he was forced to sign it to stave off a defeat. The Russian brokered truce stopped military action in and around Nagorno-Karabakh. Some 2,000 Russian peacekeepers are deployed to the region to monitor the ceasefire. Russia's permanent representative to the international organizations in Vienna says it's not prudent to mix up Iran's nuclear dossier with other issues. In a tweet, Mikhail Olyanov dismissed as wrong the idea that normalizing the situation around the Iran nuclear deal would require addressing the country's missile program or its regional behavior. Olyanov stressed that other issues have a chance to be settled only in a broader regional context. Washington withdrew from the landmark nuclear accord in 2018, launching a sanctions campaign against Iran to force it to renegotiate the deal. Tehran has repeatedly refused the renegotiation of the nuclear deal. Now, in France, people have taken to the streets of capital Paris for the second time in a week to protest a new law called the Global Security Law. Well, that makes it more difficult to film or publish pictures of police officers. Despite a large mobilization of civil society, a majority in parliament voted in favor of the controversial law. Our correspondent has more.
Thousands in Paris, tens of thousands all over France are protesting for the second time in a week against the global security law. This new law has been voted in the French parliament and makes it illegal to film and publish images of police officers. For these demonstrators, this new law is a violation of the right to inform.
We will no longer be able to film policemen in action and to put them on the social networks, which is of course very dangerous because nowadays there is a real issue in France about violence from the policemen.
Even at the very beginning of the sanitary crisis, with the total confinement, the police were controlling everybody, asking for their certificate to be able to leave their residence, you know, even though it could eventually be defendable from a sanitary point of view. Now, it has nothing to do with that. This proposed law is not directly connected to the sanitary crisis at all, and they are just giving more powers to the police.
Earlier this week, the police used tear gas and water cannon when protesters took the street in front of the French parliament. With the new law, it will become illegal to film this kind of police intervention. During the Yellow Vest movement, videos have been used in judicial investigation concerning police violence. With this law, the French state can more easily hide illegal actions committed by police officers. It can also more easily hide scandals, which opens the door for abuse of power.
For us, this law doesn't only concern journalists. During the Yellow Vest movement, we have seen an explosion of police violence. One of the important arms to fight against this is the ability to film the police violence and to denounce it. So this law is also against us, not only against journalists. There is also a surveillance of demonstrators by drones.
The French government says they want a better protection for their police force. But the new French law is seriously criticized by the Human Rights Council of the United Nations, as well as by a large spectrum of the French civil society, journalist associations, trade unions, political parties, and human rights defenders. 1 year of prison and 45,000 euros of penalties, that's what someone risks for publishing the face of a police officer. Many people here say that the French government is using the coronavirus crisis to limit personal and public liberties. Chris Den Hond, Paris.
Police have moved to break up demonstrations against racism in a formerly whites-only area in South Africa. That has made the anti-racism opposition party, Economic Freedom Fighters, angry. And that's not the first time that authorities have reacted to such demonstrations. Hassan Saria has a report from Cape Town.
There are claims of discrimination at the school that highlighted the entrenched racism which resides in the broader community here. Among the accounts, children of color were described with highly derogatory terms by teachers and fellow learners who were excluded from certain activities. And when this was protested, white individuals from the area violently attacked those raising concerns. Protesters say by perpetuating this attitude, which is reminiscent of the apartheid years, youth born under South Africa's democracy are still being taught old racial tendencies.
That we are against the racism. We are not against the white people. You must be correct with that. We are not against with white people. They are humans like us. But the way they treat us, it's like we are not humans.
But today, as before, the police were clearly set to protect the white community, blocking all efforts by the protesters to make progress. Demonstrators point to a broader issue with how the government continues to target the vulnerable.
It was just a peaceful protest because no one did anything to harm the police. We're just peacefully and then raising our voices that enough is enough. So they started to do this thing because we are black.
This is an illusion of democracy that we are getting. It's just a democracy that we have received just only to vote. But in terms of freedom, we're not free.
Scenes of a riot that we have witnessed here in this area today. Stun grenades, rubber bullets, as well as water cannons used to disperse the crowd. And so they were prevented from handing over their memorandum of demands, which of course was against racism within this area. At this point, there appears little effort by authorities to make a move against racism here. The Provincial Education Department has rejected calls by the South African Human Rights Commission for a probe or any action against teachers accused of racism. The opposition left-leaning Economic Freedom Fighters, which has led these protests, say it is this attitude that will only ensure they continue with their protests. Hassan Siria, Cape Town.
And that's a wrap for this news broadcast.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Aperture.
Welcome back to Aperture. In the first part of the documentary, we went to Singapore, an island city-state off southern Malaysia, where 5.2 million people call home. Singapore is a global financial center where one in four have a university degree and 90% own a home. By all counts, Singapore is prosperous, rich, and safe. But this is not the whole story. A 2010 survey shockingly revealed that over 9% of women in Singapore experience physical or sexual abuse from their partners, and one-third of these domestic violence victims have a college degree. We followed the stories of Rachel, Mira, and Vu as they shared their experiences of abuse, victimization, and shame. But as bad as violence and abuse is for any woman, and the situation is much worse for women who are migrants living in a foreign country, as we shall see in the rest of the program.
In 1994, Vu met and married her Singaporean husband in Ho Chi Minh City. She was 21 and he was 41. Shortly after, Vu and her husband returned to Vietnam so that her family could help look after the baby. This was when his true nature was exposed. Hoping for a better education for her daughter, Vu agreed to move back to Singapore. That was 15 years ago. Vu's husband's addiction to gambling often led to fights, but she learned to hit back. Although she could defend herself physically, he had other ways of punishing her. To remain in Singapore, Vu required a long-term social visit pass, which was renewed yearly. This visa requires a guarantor. Her husband.
The law recognizes that when someone hurts you physically, threatens you, confines you, harasses you, then that's a violation of your rights. The law does not state that if when someone abuses you verbally, emotionally, that's a violation of your rights. And so protection under the law may not be extended to the individual under those circumstances. But does it make it right? Of course not.
For the first few years, Vu was financially dependent on her husband and mother-in-law, but she slowly worked her way to independence. To make ends meet, she sold donated clothes at the Sungai Road street market. For the past 4 years, Vu has held a stable job at a fast food restaurant. With help from charities and aid agencies, her children's education is paid for. She is the breadwinner now, but her husband still holds some of the cards. Vu wants to leave her husband, but first, she needs to make sure that her right to reside in Singapore is secure. In 2 years, Vu's daughter will be 21, the required age to become her mother's guarantor in Singapore. It's the promise of the life that comes after that keeps Vu going day by day. Whether or not her dream can become reality remains to be seen.
Some foreign spouses will find it difficult to get citizenship or PR because they don't have a lot of education and also are married to men who themselves don't have a lot of education, lowly skilled, and they are seen as not being able to contribute that significantly to the Singapore economy. Because our immigration policy is very much tied to one's economic or potential economic contribution, the chances of getting the PR or citizenship are not so high. I think the immigration policy should definitely be reviewed. One, there should be some criteria so that foreign spouses can work towards making sure that in time they can actually acquire citizenship. Two, there should be some points given, you know, and a lot of points given for the fact that they have children in Singapore. And if the children are Singapore citizens, it really doesn't help the family that their mother has got such a uncertain citizenship status.
Victims of domestic violence transcend race, income, and educational background. One in three victims in Singapore have a university degree, and they are even more likely to stay silent.
There's a lot of victim blaming still going on, you know, and the very fact that people still think that, you know, I'm washing dirty linen, you know, in public when I talk about these things, you know.
Why have we still not come to a point in society where people are willing to intervene?
It's a private matter. It's between a husband and a wife. You should not interfere.
That domestic violence is a private matter. It's a...
Okay, we don't know all the facts. There's another side of the story.
I think the reason that that's so difficult, and I think you hit on two things that are really important that I think are sorely lacking right now in our society, which are one, empathy, and two, imagination. Mm-hmm. And in Singapore, these are two qualities that are not at all considered to be that important.
Once there were only two. Then it became four. Soon there will be six universities in Singapore. And more than 48% of university graduates are women. Both Rachel and Mira are professionals in the marketing industry. And like many other successful women, they have struggled with the issue of shame.
I didn't want people to know that, you know, I was like one of the statistics, you know, abused wife, and then, you know, the pity, and then, you know, the whispering, the gossiping and all that. I really didn't want any of that. So I very stupidly, you know, just kept it to myself. I didn't say anything. You know, I just put it all upon myself, you know, to try to solve the problem.
I didn't want my family to feel that I've married a terrible person, nothing. I wanted him to be respected. I didn't want to go to my family and say, this is what my husband is doing to me.
According to the International Violence Against Women survey in 2010, almost one in three victims in Singapore have a degree or postgraduate credentials.
The fact that we found a disproportionately higher number of women who were victims of violence who had university or postgraduate qualifications hammers home the point that education alone is not enough. We have done well economically, we have done well in terms of, you know, earning capacity. But in terms of how we are as a society, our values, what we see as important, perhaps there's a lot more room for improvement.
Why did these professional women stay silent?
So educated women will feel that they should be able to handle anything that happens in the family, right, including violence. And so they are not going to readily tell another party. In fact, they often try to deal with it themselves, and they are less likely to tell their friend or family member because they're much more embarrassed.
It's not just got to do with the income and the education, but really a lot has got to do also with the beliefs that we hold.
Shame, embarrassment, saving the family honor.
Perhaps it has something to do with the fact that when I think about drawing attention to my problems, I draw attention to not just shaming me as a person, but shaming my family, my community.
But if victims remain silent, do family and friends have the responsibility to speak out? That is Robert's dilemma. He has known Luke and Lena for 30 years.
I actually did not believe that he would do such a thing. So when she told me about it, she said, I don't think I want to be with him. So I told her, well, give yourself a bit of time, think about it.
Robert never imagined that his friend could be a wife beater.
We always tell him, if you know, you've got a good wife, then just, you know, control yourself. Oh no, I love my wife. I love my wife very much. I will not do such a thing. But we can see, you know, a few times when myself and my spouse met this couple, we could see on her face the black and blue marks hidden under the makeup.
When Robert accepted that his friend Luke was an abusive husband, he offered help.
I tried to help her by asking her if she needs any, you know, advice from lawyers, if she needs to get away from him. You know, we could help her find a place.
But fear has kept Lena under her own roof.
If she were to leave him, she thinks that she will lose whatever she's put into the home. And she may lose her son also.
Family violence professionals believe that the community has a larger role to play.
Violence will only stop if the society actually is more proactive, because it is really the people around the victim that have much more choices than the victim, much more choices to do something about the problem.
For most people, the hardest part is knowing when to take action and how far to go.
I have this fear factor in me that what happens in their home behind closed doors is very private. And the fear is, if I were to actually interfere in their private affairs, it may backfire. So either party has to make the first step.
Without an explicit cry for help, Robert feels he cannot act further.
If she comes to me physically and says, look, this is what has happened to me, with all the bruises and all the black and blue marks on her face or arms, I would personally think that I will bring her to a police station to make a report. But she has never at one time said, yes, help me, or I will follow your advice. So I'm in a very difficult position to report this matter to the authorities.
When is the right time to act?
There's something called the battered wife syndrome, and there are people who have been in victim mentality for many, many years, right? And the children see it, right? But are powerless, right? And so I think in some cases, you actually need to allow people like their children or even social workers to help them take that first step and to initiate the process, because otherwise they will continue to be in this situation.
Now that her son is about close to 30 years old, he's still single, she did bring this subject up to him and ask him that, she told him that one of these days I'm going to walk out of the house. I hope you will not blame me and you will support me. His answer to her regret was, this is a problem between you and dad. Don't get me involved. It really broke her heart. And she said all this while she's been living in the home for the son, yeah. And now with him saying this few words to her, she was really very disappointed.
So what do you think were Shu Wei's beliefs, though?
At workshops run by advocacy groups like AWARE, gender stereotypes are being questioned.
You should be submissive.
I accept.
You should be a housewife.
You should be able to cook.
It's your job to look after the children.
You should keep the family together.
I accept.
Brave enough.
I accept.
Macho.
You shouldn't cry.
I accept.
You're always right.
Whoa. I accept.
You are a role model.
I accept.
Without a shift in societal attitudes, responses to domestic abuse remain unchanged.
There are three typical responses when a person is confronted with domestic violence. One is to deny that it exists. Turn the other way. Don't deal with it. The other is to acknowledge it exists, but to minimize it. To say that this is a once-off thing. To say that it only affects the poorer community, the less educated, the migrants. And when these two initial responses isn't adequate, the third response is always to blame the victim.
Hearts, minds, attitudes. These are the keys to shaping a better future.
So you can do case management till the cows come home. Every case, you empower the woman, you give her all her options, and then she finds a solution, right? But it just keeps happening. So until you try to change, until you change the societal attitudes, is going to continue, and you're just going to have cases continue all the time. Yeah, so we really have to, even though it's long term, it might take 10 years, even more, but we have to start somewhere. Yeah. So this is the driving force behind the weekend campaign. It's the first time that we're actually doing a campaign that lasts more than a year, but we think this is necessary, right? So we plan for at least a 3-year campaign, and we say, if it has to be a community effort, right? So we are really just a catalyst, we provide the tools, and we try to inspire people to think about the problem and how they themselves can be part of the solution.
I would like to encourage others to not submit to other people's expectations of you.
My change is to remind people of their freedom of choice and their right to choose.
My change is to start believing in myself well. Then I think I can help others believe in themselves as well.
Mine was not a physical abusive relationship, but it was more mental and psychological that slowly deteriorated my sense of self-worth over that 24 period time frame. So I think that what, as a woman, I would like to do is reclaim my sense of self-worth and then teach my daughters what it means to be a powerful woman.
When I share my story, you know, people will say things like, what did you do? Did you do something to make him behave that way, you know? There's a lot of victim blaming still going on, you know. And the very fact that people still think that, you know, I'm washing dirty linen, you know, in public when I talk about these things, you know. But I'm very fortunate in a way that my children are very supportive of what I do. They are very proud of the work I do, you know. The more I see this, the more I feel that, you know, I should share that there's really nothing wrong in facing our demons, you know, straight on.
Mira, too, is no longer a victim.
Every day for the rest of my life, when I look into the mirror, I'm going to see that scar. But it's a scar that will tell me that I tried. I tried really hard. I got into a relationship eyes wide open with hope. However, I used to look at it and cry. Not anymore. I look at it and I feel brave about it, and I tell myself I survived. I survived because of very strong family support, really good strong friends who made sure that I was going to be strong, accepted me, allowed me to cry. I came out of a toxic marriage. Today, if I see a woman get beat up by a man, I will go and help the woman. I don't care how big that guy is going to be. I don't care if that guy is going to use vulgarities on me, but I would go rescue that woman.
Today, Rachel proudly stands her ground and openly tells her story so that other women don't have to face the same ordeal alone.
Is there any other point?
You always feel that, you know, why is this happening to me, you know, especially when you look around and, you know, people are having happy marriages, happy families, you know. And you will feel like, you know, you're so alone in the world, you know, that it's only happening to you. And that's the reason why I'm speaking out about this, you know, so that other women will know that it is not only just happening to them.
Perhaps breaking the suffocating silence is the first step in ending the issue of domestic violence and abuse. Women enduring such horrific conditions must find the courage and strength to speak out and seek help. And that's it for this week. Do join me again next time here on Aperture. But before we go, remember you can contact us either through email, Facebook, or Twitter. Goodbye for now.
Spiritual message of Islam.
His door is open no matter who you are.
take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. If we all open our eyes to see, He is all that we need right now. And we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. وبه نستعين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا ونبينا وحبيب قلوبنا وطبيب نفوسنا الذي سمي في السماء بأحمد وفي الأرضين بأبي القاسم المصطفى محمد. وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين واللعنة الدائمة على أعدائهم أجمعين من الآن إلى قيام يوم الدين. الإخوة والأخوات السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. One of the names of the day of hereafter is يوم الحسرة, the day of regret. The most important thing which comes to mind when see this term is what to do so that we don't experience this regret that I've talked about. What should be done so that we won't be one of those who regret on the day of hereafter? Or at least to lessen the possibility of regret on this certain day. When we refer to the Holy Quran and the traditions, there are three key points that come to mind with respect to lessening and decreasing the possibility of regret on the day of hereafter. These three start with Hamza in Arabic. The first one is Al-Akhlaq. The second one, Al-Ikhlas. And the third one, Al-Ijtihad. A person with having these three traits and characteristics could make sure that at least on the day of hereafter, the regret that he is going to experience is less than what he expects. So, in the coming seconds and minutes, inshallah, I will elaborate on these three key points that could be found in our riwayat and in the Holy Quran, and is emphasized on by the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wassalam. The first one was al-ikhlas, sincerity towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. With regard to ikhlas and how to achieve ikhlas, many discussions are here, and I will not go over the ways to achieve ikhlas, but I just want to refer to one way, maybe one of the most important ways to achieve ikhlas, and even other characteristics and traits and virtues, which is exercise. If a person wants to be a sincere person, a mukhlis person, the first and the most important thing to do is that he himself push himself towards ikhlas in whatever and in every single act he does. Okay, so if a person wants to even take a step forward, who thinks about this step that is taking, and thinks if it's for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala or not. And if this person exercises this way one day after another, and gradually, maybe after 1 month, I don't know, 40 days, as said in our traditions, or more or less, he will become, or he will be able to achieve the status of sincerity in other parts and in other sins of his life. This is, I think, one of the ways that has been experienced by our ulama and has been suggested and recommended by our ulama, to exercise and to push yourself to be sincere in whatever act you do.
Oh, what a wonderful world this would be if we all open our eyes to see. He is all that we need right now, and we can all come together somewhere, somehow. His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. Down this road that holds all the answers. Open your heart to something greater. His holy book speaks pure and true, and always tells us what we must do. His last prophet was sent as a guide, an example by which we abide. There is salvation for those who seek to find the one and only source of peace and understanding of why we are here, who created us, who we must fear. So what a wonderful world this would be if we all open our eyes to see. He is all that we need right now, and we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
So I just skip the first trait that I've introduced you. As I said, there are three traits, three virtues that are so important for a person who wants not to be regretful on the day of hereafter, or at least to lessen the possibility of regret on the day of hereafter. The first one was al-ikhlas. The second one is al-akhlaq, the ethical behavior or manner of a person. It's very important. We have traditions that a person who is with good manner, he will succeed in his life, and he will, his tawbah and repentance will be accepted by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and will be at last one of the people who goes to heaven. Even though there might be some problems with his actions, but since he is a mutakhalliq, he is a person with manner, so he will go to heaven. But on the other hand, the one who is not with good ethics is going to go to hell, even though he may have many good deeds in his file. So this is the importance of akhlaq. And I just want to remind you of one of the beautiful stories of Imam Hassan alayhi salam, that I'm sure that you've heard this story, but I think it's worth it to remind you once more about this beautiful story. One Syrian person, a Shami person, came to Medina, and you know about the mentality that they owned, the Syrian people at the time of Amir al-Mu'minin, at the time of Imam Hassan. They were brainwashed by the Bani Umayyad, Muawiyah la'natullahi alayhi. So this person, Imam al-Hassan alayhi salam, was passing an alley in the city of Medina. And this person with his friend were passing by the same alley. And the friend of this person said to him that, "Do you know this guy? Do you know this person?" He said, "No, I don't know him. I'm not from here." He said, "This is Hassan ibn Ali. This is the..." You know, all these flashbacks came to his mind. Who is Ali? Who is, of course, who might be his son? So he approached Imam al-Hassan alayhi salam and started swearing at Imam al-Hassan alayhi salam, shouting at him. And whatever bad words he knew, he started to throw it out of his dirty mouth. And not just to Imam al-Hassan alayhi salam, but also to his father, Imam Ali alayhi salam. And you just put yourself and place yourself in the place of this person. If a person comes and starts swearing at you, or even worse, swearing at your father, what would be the reaction of yours? Imam al-Hassan alayhi salam just waited and listen to all those nonsenses that came out of his mouth. And after he was finished, Imam Hassan al-Salam told him that, I think that you are a stranger, you're not from around. If you need anything, I can provide you with anything that you want. If you need a house to reside in or to take a rest, you can just come to my house and be my guest. If you want something to drink or to eat, you can be my guest. When he saw the reaction of Imam al-Hassan alayhi salatu wassalam, and the way Imam al-Hassan alayhi salam treated him after this insulting that he had, he was dying out of shame, and he accepted the invitation of Imam al-Hassan alayhi salatu wassalam. He stayed at the house of Imam al-Hassan for 3 days. When he was leaving the house, he said a very shocking sentence to Imam al-Hassan alayhi salam, a very strange and shocking sentence. He said, "When I entered the city of Medina, and approached you, you and your father were the worst people in my eye. But now I'm leaving this city, and you and your father are the best people ever in my mind and in my eye." So Imam al-Hassan alayhi salatu wassalam, with akhlaq and with practicing ethics, made a nasabi, one of the enemies of Ahlul Bayt. If I want to call it in the language of the day, I would call him a Wahhabi, a very extreme Wahhabi, an extremist Wahhabi. He made him to convert to be on the path of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. By what? By showing akhlaq and by practicing akhlaq. Imam al-Hassan alayhi salatu wassalam could have had him arrested, because he was at that time either the caliph or the son of the caliph. I cannot recall what was the era that this story happened. But I'm sure that at that time, for sure, he was either the khalifa or the caliph or the son of the caliph. So he had power. He could have had him arrested. He could have had him, of course, killed. But he didn't do this. He just waited and practiced akhlaq and made this nasabi or this wahhabi in the current language to become a Shia, to become a follower of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wassalam. And this is akhlaq. This is how akhlaq works. I ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to enable us to be one of the people who enjoy these three traits, al-ikhlas, ijtihad, and al-akhlaq, and be inshallah amongst the real followers of Ahlul Bayt and the real followers of Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam. I think that would be enough for this night. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. فارشي التراب يضمني وهو غطائي حولي الرمال تلفني بل من ورائي واللحد يحكي ظلمة فيها ابتلائي والنور خط كتابه أنسي والصحب أين نجمون.
what you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.